Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Ryzen 7 pre-orders. Let's talk pricing, motherboards, and more. The FCC's opened up 5 gigahertz LTEU, a review of the tiny, silent $150 Leva Z PC, and quite a bit more. All coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twitch audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 403, recorded February 23rd, 2017. Ryzen is almost here.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code Twitch to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase. And by Zipcar. Zipcar is the largest car sharing network in the world. Turn $25 in driving credit. Visit joinzipcar.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that is here to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most delightful, and probably this week the most excited news about PC hardware available anywhere on the interwebs. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Shrout.
Hey, what's going on? Finally here, back. I don't know. I've been traveling a lot. I'm sorry.
It's Ryzen week, man. So you're jet lagged and air lagged and hotel roomed out and just.
It's like Ryzen week one of two because they cheated by doing pre-orders, right? So
harsh, you know, but fair.
Well, I know. Whatever. They gave a lot of interesting justifications for why they wanted to do pre-orders, which are interesting, but it's just not something that really happens on PC hardware, so it feels a little odd. And usually I'm poo-pooing the idea of pre-orders for just about anything, like PC software, games, mm-hmm. any of that type of stuff. So whatever. Clearly there was some pent-up demand, as you might see.
Well, people have been waiting for a long time. People have been excited. People have been wondering about Ryzen since last summer, right? Because they're like, 8-core, magnificent performance, no money. Sign me up. And AMD's like, we'll get back to you. And it's CES, you know, big bloom of coverage. And then this week, apparently events in San Francisco, which you may have been in attendance at.
I was, yeah.
You do have nothing to say about what you saw?
Well, I thought I was interrupting you, so I was going to let you continue your No, it was an interesting event, right? It was it was, you know, the CEO of AMD, it was the CTO of AMD, it was all the PR marketing people and all the product design people. Like, this was their official unveiling to the media, and they released a video of part of it, and then, you know, they announced that there were going to be pre-orders the next day, which was yesterday, which was a surprise to everybody. And they actually announced most of the important specifications, I would say. So your clock speeds, your cache sizes, the prices, which are obviously very important. And then, you know, our reviews will be able to go up on March 2nd when the processors actually ship. Right. My main complaint is I hate even encouraging people to put money down on a product until they know where it stands and performance wise, right? Whether they're working at a specific workload or a specific benchmark or a specific piece of software that they want to evaluate. I think that's important, not just for games, but for hardware and everything else in between. But from their point of view, the idea of a pre-order was simply a get in line type of thing. And for a lot of their partners, this is interesting business insight, right? A lot of their SI partners, your system integrators, your Dells, your HPs, your Alienwares, your Main Gears, all those types of stuff. Like, they want to know what the interest and demand is going to be before they start to place their orders for stuff. And AMD had no track record for that for the last decade, You know, if somebody was going to estimate how many Ryzen parts to order based on how many AMD FX parts to order, that's a bad deal for them. So the idea of getting a pre-orders is they now have some sales numbers to kind of go forward and look and say, okay, look, we sold this many thousands of processors day one and week one and go forward from there. I can tell you anecdotally, like the links on our site go to our Amazon affiliate code or whatever. And so I can get a general idea of what people are buying and what their total is. Mm-hmm. There was more hardware sold on yesterday through that affiliate setup on our site than in any other day I can ever remember. And that includes like Black Fridays and, you know, going back many years. So, and I've seen, you can track some semblance of what they're ordering. There are a lot of processors and motherboards in there, obviously for Ryzen, but then they're buying SSDs, they're buying video cards, they're buying power supplies and cases, they're buying new systems. So I don't know how long that kind of rush will last, but there was clearly a pent-up demand for people that wanted these processors, and they were using that as the jumping-off point for full system builds, full system upgrades.
Well, certainly people have been waiting for a while. And, of course, there's been a lot of, I'm going to flat out call it anger and frustration. I, like you, know a lot of enthusiasts, not just in the gaming area, but in terms of video production, people do some you know, heavy duty engineering, 3D creation apps. I think I said video editing already. People who are programmers working with you know, complicated, huge data sets who can, you know, literally go like, if I can, you know, compile this much faster, or if I can go through this, you know, gigantic SQL database this much faster, then I can do this much more work, and that goes straight into my pocket. So the last, certainly Hobby Lake, while delightful from a mobile perspective, in terms of adding additional battery life, has been for high-end users a disappointment. I'm going to flat out say it. And I mean, let's go back to kind of like everything we know at this point, right? Pre-orders are going on now. You're talking about the you've got a pretty good chart up on PCPro.com where you're looking at basically the Ryzen 7 1800X selling for $499. That's the premier. That's, and before I get any further, let's just say all of the processors, whether you're talking about the 1700, the 1700X, or the 1800X, they're all running 4 megabytes of cache. They're L2 cache, 16 megabytes of L3 cache. They're all in an AM4 socket. They all offer the extended frequency range. They are all 8 core, 16 threads. They are all unlocked. That said, you need to be careful in choosing your motherboard. The X370, which is their enthusiast chipset, that does overclocking. The B350, their mainstream chipset, does overclocking. What they call the enthusiast SFF, the X300 chipset, also does overclocking. But the A320, which is their essential, and the A300 essential SFF, do not offer overclocking. I got to say, as somebody who was, you know, waiting, hands on keyboard, logged into Amazon yesterday, ready to purchase, I couldn't find actually the, you know, it took me 15 minutes of random searching and links and going back through AMD's Ryzen links to finally find a processor I could buy. Well, you know, I think you're the one who convinced me. I was like, I don't want to buy this and then be waiting 6 weeks. You convinced me to go ahead and buy it. The 1700, which sells for $329, was sold out at that point, or at least appeared to be based on Amazon's website yesterday. Yeah. And I think this is a very fluid situation because all the stuff you couldn't find yesterday is pretty easy to find now on Amazon.com.
But the only exception the only exception to that is the 1800X. Yeah. As I looked throughout the afternoon here, the 17 and 1700X were in there, but the 1800X was listed as unavailable. I think maybe Newegg still had some of them, but it was clearly what happened yesterday is, you know, Amazon's given like a number by AMD. Here's how many we'll be able to have to you. And then they reach that number. And Amazon goes back to AMD and says, well, we promise we'll be able to get you this many more. And so they open up the pre-orders again. So, yeah.
It was a pretty crazy day. And I'm normally willing to wait, but I'm excited about this. I want to test one. It's looking at the pricing. The Ryzen 7 1700 is pretty much at the same level as a 6700K. Can you talk about what you have in for testing at this point, or is that secrets until the second?
No, I could talk about it. The only part that I have in now is the R7 1800X, so the highest end, highest price part, $499. They did not send me the 1700 or the 1700X. I have specifically requested both the 1700 and 1700X because I feel like being able to tell the whole story about all three of these products is actually going to be really important for people looking to buy after the fact of the launch. AMD revealed some, like, a couple of benchmarks for each of these. Obviously, ones that make them look pretty good, right?
You're kidding.
Weird surprise, right? The 1800X is $500, but it's super, super impressive in that it's competing against a $1,000 part, the Core i7-6900K that we see there in that graph, right? To me, though, perhaps more interesting is the Core i7-7700K versus the Ryzen R7 1700. In single-threaded results, the 7700K is going to be faster because it's better IPC and it's a higher clock speed.
Right.
But anything you do that is multi-threaded to any kind of degree, whether you're doing video encoding, you're working on video editing, those types of things, like you have twice as many cores on the 1700 as you do over the 7700K. And that's going to be a significant delta in performance. I mean, you can see it right there. You're talking about like, this is Cinebench R15. So it's, you know, best case multi-threading, but you're talking about 1410 versus 967. So, you know, more than 40% better. It's really going to be how much emphasis do you put on single-threaded and how much emphasis do you put on multi-threaded from there? Because that price delta isn't nearly as extreme. That R7 1700 is $329 and the 7700K is like $350. So you can't make the same argument on price as you can like the 1800X versus the 6900K. You would be say, oh, I'm willing to sacrifice some single-threaded performance in order to get that multi-threaded performance and save $500 that I can put into a higher capacity SSD or a higher end GPU or something. It's, you know, you're talking about $30 down on that on the other side there. So it's a little bit different. But I still think in my book, that's going to be the one that kind of has the most wow potential to it in terms of just like selling a lot through. But the rule of middle selection is still there.
Well, let's see. It looks like, you know, I mean, AMD Ryzen 1700 item will be released March 2nd, 2017, $329. I could really, really upset my wife and go ahead and order the Ryzen 7 1700 to see if it shows up along with the 1800.
Yeah. Yeah. Could do that.
If you see a couch behind me next week, it didn't go well. But so, you know, as we were talking about, right, $329 for the 1700, which is, you know, online with like a 6700K. The 3.8 gigahertz 1700X is selling for $399, and then the 1800X is selling for $499. I personally am extremely curious to basically grab one of my 3 gigabyte files and start rendering in Handbrake to see if this scales. Handbrake should scale well up to 6 cores. The last couple cores isn't going to do much good, according to the Handbrake folks, but I'm really curious to get my hands on it and see what the performance looks like. So it's nice to see that Amazon's kind of gotten straightened out, and it does look like there is some availability left.
I forgot I had put this one here. This is the performance per dollar one, which is really interesting, right? And again, it's really the top one there is huge gap. But even on the R7 1700 versus the 7700K, there's a pretty big gap when you factor in the price. So it'll be interesting.
If it delivers, it will be amazing. And if anybody's wondering why I keep talking about the 6700K versus the Core i7 7700K, it's because I have a 6700K sitting right next to me, and it's basically the same desktop performance as a 7700K, or within like 10%. The 7700K is selling for $339, and the 6700K is selling for $317. So it's not like there's a huge delta between those two generations of Intel parts, which again opens up the door for people to be excited about an enthusiast part that's going to deliver performance, especially if it delivers, the performance per dollar. Man, that is the big story with what's going on with AMD. You took a look at Ryzen powered PC pre-orders, CyberPower, Main Gear, Origin, NCIX. I think they had close to a dozen manufacturers on display at their booth at CES.
Yeah.
So I would expect as supply becomes available, we'll see more of those. You know, I don't expect Dell to adopt this. Will HP adopt this part?
I think Dell definitely will, and HP definitely will. The question will always be how many SKUs and how much are they pushing it? You know, the SIs like CyberPower, Main Gear, Origin, those guys are going to push it hard. They've had good partnerships with AMD. And it's been a long time since they could push an AMD, you know, as long as anybody else, I guess, push AMD as a flagship processor choice. I think Dell and HP are probably, you know, they're don't get me wrong, they're super cozy with Intel, but they would love anything to give them a little bit more negotiating room with Intel on chipsets and processors. And having AMD there and having a couple of their systems using that platform is going to give them a little bit more of an edge in those negotiations for sure. You know, Alienware will use them, and they're a component of Dell, but we'll see in the long term what that actually means for mainstream OEMs. I think we probably need to get into the Ryzen R5s, R3s, whatever the lower cost parts before you really see Dell and HP and like the kind of OEM builds get into it, because $329 is still pretty high end for a Dell machine. So we need to get down to like the $200 range for that to be the big push.
We wait with bated breath, which has really been a theme for me this year. BioStar launched their X370 GT7 flagship motherboard for Ryzen CPUs. They are, you know, focusing on the X370 B350 chipsets. The GT7 is their top of the line. I have all the money. I want all of the carbon fiber enclosing my things option. I love the spacing on that motherboard in between the 16 PCI Express slots. I should also point out the armor over the rear I/O edge is backlit with LEDs.
Nice.
So, nice. Yeah, heat spreaders on the chipsets. You know, this is kind of typical for the high-end boards we're seeing.
Yeah. Another interesting kind of avenue, I'm sorry, this is kind of a scattershot discussion, is on the motherboard side, I had initially thought that we would see only higher-priced boards. Like X370 boards were going to be fairly expensive. But we've actually, you know, B350 shares almost every capability that the X370 has except dual GPU support. Like it only supports a single graphics card. You can't do SLI or Crossfire. And I think it limits like the USB 3.1 connections from 6 to 2 or something like that. There's very few differences between those two chipsets. And I'm pretty sure you could overclock on both of them.
You can overclock on the X370, the B350, and the A300.
Okay, so the B350 you can as well. Okay, so like if you're not a multi GPU person, there are a lot of motherboards in the $100 to $110 range out there that are launching on pre-order today that are really compelling, and you pair that with a $300, $400 processor, and you're good.
If I could have purchased an AMD Ryzen processor off Amazon yesterday without having it bundled with an X370 based motherboard, I would have.
Yeah.
You know, I ended up with a Prime X370 Pro, which, you know,
that's a good one.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It looks like it's a fantastic motherboard. I would have been perfectly happy with a B350 based motherboard. I mean, I was pretty excited to see Asus showing up with a bunch of motherboards at launch. You know, just because I wasn't sure they were going to be there, and I've been really happy with Asus motherboards over the last couple of years, or period. But I think for most people, the B350 is the way to go, because we just have such a small segment of people that actually end up doing Crossfire LSI. And the Enthusiast SFF actually looks pretty good, too. I don't know. I'm excited to get it running and see how well it does. I find it also really amusing, you know, the AMD motherboards are up on the Asus website, but if you go to the AMD platform on the Asus website, the new AM4 motherboards are not listed there.
Yeah, so, there's a lot of confusion in those areas, it seemed.
Yeah, it's not as if this hasn't been building for months, so it's been kind of amusing to watch how the data trickles out, and you know, you know, maybe this is part of the reason why AMD wanted to sort of separate the launch from the actual delivery of the processors. You know, it's been interesting to watch, to say the very least. Or be a part of, to say the very least. But I'm pretty excited with the motherboard. The other thing that's kind of been going on is, I guess AMD was showing off in the Vega graphics card again at San Francisco this week. I think Tech Report got a write-up on that, one of the first ones I saw, you know, in the demo room. I like what they said. Jeff Campman over at Tech Report writes, the company finally did away with the gaffer tape and solid cases and showed off a Vega graphics card in the buff, which makes it sound so risque. but, you know, it looks like a GPU with a couple of power connectors on it.
Yeah, it's a development board, so it's got this weird USB plug coming out the back of it. I think I'm positive it's the same reference board they showed at CES to a couple of people. And, you know, they had it... it was obnoxiously loud, but it was on purpose. They said they had the fan maxed out at 100% just so the media couldn't, like, gauge how loud it was in general, right? They couldn't, like, see how loud it was during a normal workload, right? So they just jacked the fan speed all the way up to 100% so that we had no choice but to say, we don't know what the fan speed would have been. Therefore, we don't know what the temperatures were. We don't know what the noise levels would have been, that type of thing. You know, they're watching it. You know, they've got a couple more months on that process.
One last thing I want to throw out. If you are motherboard shopping, WCCF Tech has the entire range, as of February 19th, the entire range of AMD Ryzen AM4 motherboards pictured in full detail, X370, B350, A320 products, Asus, Gigabyte, MSI, and ASRock. So if you are having difficulty tracking down the motherboard availability, this is certainly one way of doing it and working your way through. That Crosshair 7 Hero looks really gorgeous. Mostly, it's the second or third one down, one more down. Not so much one more up. Not so much because of, like, the backlighting on the cover on the back next to the memory, which you probably can't even see if you're watching the video, but by the fact that I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 3.0 USB slots and what might be as many as either 4 2.0 or 3.1. I think it's USB 3.1 ports on the back of that. I'm excited about having that many USB ports natively on a motherboard because I'm tired of having to have a hub plugged into my system to be able to get all of the things plugged in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Tracker. We're all used to losing our possessions. Newsweek reports the average American wastes 55 minutes a day. Who's got 55 minutes to waste? I don't. You don't. Which is why you should be checking out the Tracker instead of looking for the things you own and can't find. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. And I'm going to tell you how to get one for free. The Tracker Bravo locates misplaced keys, wallets, luggage, instruments, bicycles, electronic devices, even pets in seconds. A coin-sized device constructed with anodized aluminum for the thinnest, most durable tracking. You can easily attach it to your items via key loop or adhesive. It's enabled by Bluetooth LE, so the battery lasts up to a year. You can add a laser-engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, like return information or your pet's name and your phone number. And you can now personalize your tracker with a custom printed image. In fact, I think somewhere we have one with Ryan's face on it. Pair the tracker to your iOS or Android device and find its precise location with a tap of a button. It is that easy. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once. You can customize two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind. If you lose your phone, just press the button on the tracker. Your phone will ring even if it's on silent. With over 3.5 million devices shipped, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your lost item shows up on a map even if it's miles away. If you lose your item, the Tracker app records its last known location on a map. When another Tracker user comes within a 100-foot range of your item, you will receive a GPS update of where your item is located. If that sounds good to you, and it should, go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter in the promo code Twitch, you'll get a free Tracker Bravo with your order. That's thetracker.com, promo code Twitch, to get your free Tracker Bravo today. It's time to stop losing things. Seriously. I had some fun this week on Tech Thing. We got ECS debuted a whole stack of low power PCs. And I got to take a look at the Leva Z, selling for $149. And I was, some people have suggested to me that I shouldn't have been trying to run Mint Linux on it, that I should have used a more up-to-date kernel, because the Mint Linux kernel is probably not ready to handle the Apollo Lake SoC, the system on a chip inside of the Leva Z, but it is tiny. It actually feels smaller than a Nook. It's air-cooled. There's no fan. It's silent. Supposed to max out at 6 watts on the power consumption. Dual-core, 1 gigahertz processor that turbos up to 2.4 gigahertz. It's an eMMC drive, which is not my favorite. I would have rather it had an M.2 or an SSD. Oh, yeah. But there is a M.2 slot on there. 802.11ac Wi-Fi built in. It's supposed to support 4K ultra high definition resolution. I think it's only doing HD 1.4, not 2.0. There's a VESA mount on it. Weighs nothing. Running Windows 10, I was actually surprised at how well it ran, because I, you know, with a dual core processor, multitasking is possible, but not exactly awe inspiring. But I had Netflix running, browser windows, WordPad, everything went pretty well. I did not enjoy the performance under Mint Linux, but again, I'm going to try a faster version of Linux. But I think my favorite part about this, along with the three USB 3.0 ports and the USB-C port on the front, is the fact that it's got a pair of Ethernet ports on the back, which screams PFSense build to me. So I'm going to try to build a PFSense box on this and see how well it does with that. So, if you're looking for a very, very small, fairly powerful PC, well, fairly, fairly small, inexpensive, reasonably performing PC, because I don't think on my best day I can call a Celeron N3350 system on a chip powerful, but capable. Right. It's got potential. Basically, DDR3L SODIMM modules, 4 gigabytes in the box. You can max it out at 8 gigabytes. It has potential. And then they do, that's $149, and a 64 gigabyte eMMC version is available for $189. And they have some additional Leva devices that get faster processors, consume more power, and have the options of using SDs for expansion. So if you're in the market, or if you're looking for something a little more powerful than a Raspberry Pi to run as a media box attached to your television, keep an eye on the Leva Z. Somewhat cool. Larger. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think Sebastian has one of these, and he was just starting doing some testing too, so I'll be curious to see what his thoughts are on it. I know he's messing around with a lot of those super small form factor machines to various degrees of interest, I would say. But they keep getting better, so that's a plus.
I did not bother to benchmark it. After running Handbrake on the new XPS 13 2-in-1 last week, and seeing the somewhat less than awe-inspiring performance on that, I've realized that, you know, if it's a small, low-power machine, you shouldn't be rendering video on it.
Right.
You should be using it for other things. So I'll be curious to hear what he thinks of it. Somewhat larger, probably somewhat louder, the Corsair Bulldog, which is, depending on how you look at it, a home theater PC or gaming PC designed for 4K gaming. So is this the enclosure and the power supply, or was it a fully built system?
So this is a bare bones system. The for $399, you get the chassis, you get the motherboard pre-installed, you get the power supply pre-installed, and you get the cooler, the CPU cooler pre-installed, minus, you know, it's not attached to the motherboard yet. It's the fan and radiator is mounted. So then you add the CPU, you add the memory, your storage, SSD or hard drive or both, and then you get a GPU, and you have a fully functioning system in there. And what's interesting about it is that, you know, the Bulldog system itself is, this is version 2.0, but the main change is that they've used like PWM fans that are, you know, a little bit quieter when you're not gaming, when you're just idling or watching video or whatever, the system is definitely quieter. And then they upgraded from a Z170 board to a Z270 board. So the design of the chassis, you either liked it before or you didn't, mm-hmm. and that's not going to change any at this point. If you think the physical look of it is ugly, then you're still going to think that's the case. If you still think that it looks good, and it also is really nice because it just kind of it's built to fit into that home theater PC infrastructure, then you're still going to feel that way about it there. It's definitely it's people hate it and people love it, right? And we'll leave the design side at that. But from a construction standpoint, it's actually pretty neatly constructed because you can still put full power, full size components in this, right? So right. If you watch the video we posted, you know, we're using a Core i7 7700K part. We're using a water-cooled, like self-contained water-cooled GTX 1080 graphics card. It can fit up to 3 SSDs or 1 SSD and 1 hard drive in it. Mm-hmm. And it all works really well. And I mean, and it's, you know, we talk about home theater PC designs quite a bit, but a lot of times you have restrictions on what kind of hardware you can use and that type of stuff. And Corsair kind of gets around that by giving you the CPU cooler already. One of the biggest complaints is like, oh, I need to find this low profile CPU cooler. And am I sure it's going to offer enough cooling for the performance that I want to integrate? You don't have any of those concerns with the H6F that they included in this. Mounting the GPU is a little bit of a problem, as you can see in the video here, because it uses a ribbon cable extension for it. So it kind of mounts parallel with the motherboard as opposed to perpendicular, like in every other case, again, because of the size restrictions of the HTPC style design. But everything goes in. Like most home theater PC cases, you have to worry about cable routing a little bit more than you would normally, and making sure things are kind of installed in the right order so you don't, you know, let's say, for example, you installed the graphics card before you actually attached the power cable to the graphics card. Now, routing that power cable is extremely difficult. So it's actually a little bit better to take the video card back out, attach the power cable, and then put the video card back in. So there's, you know, a little bit of eccentricity in the design for that. But Corsair is pretty upfront about it in their instruction manuals about how you do it. And when you put it all together, I didn't do a whole bunch of benchmarking on it because, you know, these are all components that we're pretty familiar with. And they're not going to perform differently just because of the system we're in, as long as the cooling is effective. But I did use this opportunity to hook this up to the 4K OLED LG B6 TV that I had purchased and played some Resident Evil in HDR. And that's really good. This is really good looking. This is not a review of Resident Evil 7 in any degree or that TV, but I will say that it was awesome looking, and the Corsair system powered it. You know, and at any system, any PC with a 1080 in it is going to be able to do that. But we got this in a home theater design, and it was interesting to see. Right? You know, it was louder while it was gaming than when you were watching video. But again, that's kind of for the course when it comes to these types of things. So and for $399, it's not a bad deal for the case, the motherboard, the power supply, and the CPU cooler. And you have all the functionality you need to build a pretty killer 4K gaming rig or whatever you need to do for something in that form factor.
Yeah, I think the best part is that unlike so many home theater PCs in the past, it is not covered with giant bright blue LEDs on the front.
Yeah. Yeah. I can support that completely, for sure.
I can't look at my screen because of the giant blue display. Oh, my goodness. It seems obvious, but apparently not back in the day.
Not to everybody.
I actually say Scott took some time to write thoughts on Vulkan 1 year later. The Vulkan API released a year ago, which is the open fork of AMD's Mantle. So, you know, drivers for developers to work with, some public SDKs, the specification. What has happened in the last year since Vulkan was set loose to change the world?
Yeah, it really depends on your point of view. My separating away from what Scott's story might be, I would say that it hasn't made the impact that I thought it would make. A year is not a whole lot of time in game development cycles, right? And I want to be very clear about that. I'm not, you know, saying that it's dead or anything. And you had one really great flagship example of its use case in Doom that it came out with. And you've had a couple of other smaller ones. Mm-hmm. But that API, I think, still has long legs. It will still have huge growth ahead of it. And it may be more in the mobile space than in the PC space. And that's fine. It's going to be utilized there. It's OpenGL is the big mobile, you know, smartphone API for Android and iOS to some degree. And I think Vulkan will eventually replace that. What will it do on the PC side? I don't know. It really depends on how continually aggressive Microsoft is with DirectX and the feature sets and the capabilities that it's going to offer. But more as it talks about here, you know, the SIGGRAPH, they're always promoting and pushing these updates and these changes, you know, new feature sets. But they did quote, and actually, I guess this is an important point here, is that it is in Unreal Engine 4.14, which is probably the most important engine in game development. So now we may start to see a trickling of Vulkan-enabled games because now the developers don't have to spend quite as much effort to integrate it. And then maybe we see a flood of them. I don't know. I'll be curious to see what that turns out to be over the next, I don't know, what, 10 months into 2017.
Should be interesting. I should point out, by the way, if you dig around on the carousel on the front page of Asus.com, there is a tab that should link to the Asus motherboards for the Ryzen 7 launch. If it doesn't just turn into one giant 17-page graphics-heavy display of your ROG motherboard. Choose your things carefully.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, my goodness. Owning a car is expensive. It's a lot of money, especially if you got a car payment, you got car insurance. If it's a new car, the car insurance probably is pretty hefty. So this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Zipcar. Zipcar is the world's largest car sharing network, operating in over 500 cities, towns, colleges, and more than 50 airports around the world. Zipcar provides a cost-effective alternative to car ownership. Zipsters pay only for the time they actually use a vehicle and have no responsibility for additional costs. You drive a car by the hour or by the day with gas and insurance included. How nice is that? And with Zipcar, you'll have the freedom to choose when and where you want to drive. Zipcar's self-service vehicles are available on demand in conveniently located reserved parking spots in your neighborhood. You can reserve your Zipcar in minutes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by calling or visiting the website. Simply book the vehicle of your choosing and unlock your selected vehicle with your Zipcar. It's really easy. Zipcar offers over 50 makes and models of cars that range from environmentally friendly hybrids, EVs, and PHEVs to luxury vehicles, SUVs, pickup trucks, and cargo vans, because sometimes you got to haul furniture around. You'll have the option to choose the make, the model, the type, even the color of the vehicle you want based on the needs of each trip and the available Zipcars in your area. Reserving, accessing, and using a Zipcar is as easy as getting cash from an ATM. And car sharing is good for the environment. Zipsters reduce their personal CO2 emissions by between 1,100 and 1,600 pounds per year. And they don't have to stand online and wait and wait and wait. For wheels when you want them and $25 in driving credit, go to joinzipcar.com/twit. That's joinzipcar.com/twit. And we thank Zipcar for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Indeed.
Indeed. Oh, my goodness. 5 gigahertz, 5G LTE, you know, Windows Mobile Congress, Windows World Mobile Congress.
Close.
We'll know all the new cell phones and possibly a new tablet from Samsung by next Thursday. Right now, we're seeing some kind of follow-ups on stuff we talked about back at CES. FCC's opened up 5 gigahertz spectrum to unlicensed LTE use. They certified equipment from Ericsson and Nokia and that's good. T-Mobile is going to start using the new technology this spring. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai said, "This is a significant advance in wireless innovation and a big win for wireless consumers." So, you know,
it's really hard to explain, and I don't pretend to understand it 100% completely, but the use of unlicensed spectrum in this place is what will allow carriers to, without having to worry about paying these fees, these licensing fees, to accelerate the adoption of better technologies, right? So gigabit LTE was launched a couple of a month ago, a few weeks ago down in Australia. T-Mobile has announced they want to do gigabit LTE in the U.S. Right. I believe AT&T said they were going to do it as well. This, you can do it without unlicensed, but this makes it much easier and quicker for them to adopt, right? And by using, right, you know, carrier aggregation and these other technologies, they are able to kind of merge the capabilities of these multiple different spectrum bands and mm-hmm. improve the overall kind of market and experience for people, if you will. So LTEU is something that Qualcomm's talked about for a long time because they were banging that drum for their modems for a while. I think they're the only shipping modem that supports unlicensed. Now, whether or not that matters as other modems are coming out, as unlicensed just even kind of starts to be adopted by any carriers, we'll see. Mm-hmm. But they say, yeah, the FCC certified LTE unlicensed equipment from Ericsson and Nokia. So that's kind of stuff that would go on the tower side or in local. Like, this is something that would be in dense urban areas or campuses, things like that, whether it be work or school campuses, to really be. It'll be interesting to see how it improves that, right? The benefits of LTE go well beyond where we're at now.
I think one of the interesting, the article we linked to on this one is from multichannel.com. They also have a really great, what they wrote, the summer guide to the LTEU dust up, which is, there is a lot of concern. I'm going to quote, Leslie Ellis, in a summer guide to the LTE-U dust up. Among LTEU's more vocal detractors to the LTEU proliferation include Cablevision Systems, Microsoft, the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, Ruckus Wireless, Viasat, and pretty much everyone else with a business model that requires a healthy and growing Wi-Fi network. So certainly Cable Labs is trying to figure out how badly LTEU will or will not impact Wi-Fi. There's some real concern around that. And one of the other articles or titles I saw linking back to the FCC approving LTEU was a quote that said, "Sounds good. Can we now also use some 700 megahertz bandwidth?" Which would be much more effective in going over distances. And unlike 5 gigahertz, is not currently being used by a metric ton of consumer devices out there. So, the Wi-Fi Alliance has an LTEU testing plan, and I will be curious to see how it does or does not impact consumers using Wi-Fi. Verizon says they're going to be testing, by the way, their 5G service in 11 cities by the middle of 2017, not for mobile use, but as a replacement for home or office broadband. CNET wrote that article up, and while I'm in a mobile mood, Qualcomm has announced a new VR dev kit and headset accelerator program. Lucas Matney wrote that up at TechCrunch. Quote, "The near future of VR is definitely mobile, and for the time being, nobody has more control of the guts of mobile devices than Qualcomm does." So, then they've talked about the VR820 reference design for that, and, the idea that there may be a lot more mobile, high-end cell phones doing mobile VR or VR on mobile devices before we see the high-end headsets really take off in terms of scale.
The benefit of this program that they started is they basically created a reference design that any vendor can now take with a couple of options here and there, choose device A, choose device B, and then easily take it to market, right? Just kind of rebrand, white box, whatever you want to call it, and take it to market using Snapdragon 835. And, you'll imagine that they'll have other versions down the line as well for it. And that's what I think it will be really important to get more of these devices out there that are high power, but also kind of dedicated devices that you don't just like swap your phone in and out. I think those are really interesting, but I think maybe people aren't really apt to lose their battery life, to VR on a daily basis. And then, that type of stuff. This is a device you can put on, wear for a couple of hours, set down on your desk, plug it into charge, leave, take your phone with you. You don't have to worry about it being dead all the way.
All the way, all the time.
Forever.
Every time you do anything, your phone's going to die. Oh my goodness. The other thing that happened that was kind of sad is ZTE is shutting down. ZTE came up with a really interesting idea. I got to see the presentation for it at CES this year. Their Hawkeye phone, which essentially is a sticky phone that will allow you to turn pages while you're reading with eye gestures. It was, started out as Project CSX, and it was using some of their, super users, their most enthusiastic user base off their forums to help design a new phone concept. They launched it on Kickstarter, and ZTI ended the Kickstarter project when they realized they had $36,000 out of its $500,000 funding goal to bring the phone to fruition. So
yeah,
their forums kind of voted on the features and brought it out. They did a big launch of it at CES, but unfortunately the support was not there on Kickstarter. They had 190 backers, and they needed a lot more, to use highly technical terms, to make it a real product that would be sold. So I'm sorry, Hawkeye. It was us, not you. In our continuing iOS 8, iPhone 8 rumors watch, the latest comes from Mac Rumors. The idea of a revolutionary front camera with 3D sensing abilities. Yeah. Basically, multiple modules. And this is another KGI Securities analyst report, which I think means that somebody over there is tapped in and quietly leaking all of the information, possibly on behalf of Apple. Apple's busy. They're moving into their new people warehouse or new office building.
I like that term, a people warehouse.
People warehouse. Infrared transmitting module and infrared receiving module. The same kind of, in addition to a front facing or the front camera. Quote, the camera will function by merging the depth information captured by the IR transmitting and receiving modules with the traditional 2D images captured by the front camera. This could not only be used for the iPhone 8's long-rumored iris recognition feature, but in some gaming applications and future AR/VR experiences where users could place their own 3D scanned face in the game using a quick selfie. Because nothing says, I want to spend $1,000 on a new phone, like being able to stuff your face inside a Flappy Bird.
Mocking. The Kinect tried that, and I don't remember it being a wildly successful or barn-burning feature, so...
Well, Apple's Apple, and I suspect that is not the only thing Apple has planned for the new feature. Sasha Sagan over PC Mag talks about Intel 7560 modem, which could push the next iPhone to 1 gigabit per second, assuming you can actually get that kind of bandwidth from your carrier. And not to be left out, there's a good read up on PC Per. Qualcomm announces the Snapdragon X20 LTE mobile and modem are just difficult words for me today. That's their second generation gigabit LTE running on a 10 megabit FinFET process and offering, quote, what Qualcomm says are a number of industry firsts, which include first a category 18 downlink and the first to receive up to 12 spatial LTE data streams simultaneously. I have an acquaintance in Australia who is currently running like something in the neighborhood of even faster. Basically, I think he's getting 800 and 900 megabits per second on a service he's playing with right now. So,
yeah.
Assuming I won't go through all of my bandwidth in 15 or 20 minutes based on the data plans that are available, I'm kind of excited about this. Yeah, Category 18 download speeds up to 1.2 gigabits per second, which is a 20% improvement in download speeds over the previous generation. So... 4x4 MIMO on up to 3 aggregated LTE carriers, up to 5x20 megahertz downlink carrier aggregation across licensed and unlicensed FDD and TDD radio frequencies, which I think means 5 gigahertz. This is, it's going to be a lot of speed coming to mobile devices, or at least their wireless connections, as soon as the carriers catch up, which should be 2018, 2019, 2020, depending on the build out. There you have it. So, I think Ryan probably has to run back to the other part of the PC Perf facility right now to hit play on the next benchmark. and you can pretty much trust that we are going to be all about the new cell phones and the Ryzen benchmarks on next week's episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Anything else that do you remotely have any bandwidth to discuss anything else next week?
Processors. NVIDIA has put a countdown timer up on their website with the letters TI highlighted. So that might give you a clue about next week as well. That's it. I hope that's it, because that's all I got. I don't even think I have enough for that, but that's all it's going to try.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. With that, I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me on Tech Thing and AV Excel when I'm not on This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find This Week in Computer Hardware at twit.tv/Twitch. You can find Mr. Ryan Shrout at pcper.com. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. We hope to see you next week. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.